She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Welcome to Casual Trek, where two honorable warriors encounter and battle three episodes of Star Trek to determine which ones are worthy of Stover Corps and which shall experience Beesh!
Experience Beesh!
Beesh! We are brought to you by the House of Nerd and Ty, a most dishonorable house. I am Charlie, son of Jez, and I once defeated a boy in combat with a cricket bat. I too was a boy, so there is no shame in it.
I am Miles, son of Phil, and I once gave someone a concussion with a 1 pound bag of coffee.
So yeah, you might not have picked up on the subtle hint, but we've been doing some watching of Klingon-based episodes of Star Trek.
Oh, shit, I was watching some Hirogen episodes from Voyager instead.
Oh, dear. Oh,
we've actually not done anything with the Hirogens.
No. I don't even remember who the Hirogens are. This is Casual Trek, after all.
I think they're basically like Star Trek's equivalent of the Predator.
Oh, those guys.
Yeah, they're a race of hunters.
We could probably do some kind of Predator-adjacent episode. But before we go on to some honourable and some very dishonourable episodes. Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, my wife and I went to the cinema yesterday and we saw a film by the YouTuber Markiplier, and that's Iron Lung, which is based on the indie game of the same name.
I have no knowledge of any of these things. I'm aware Markiplier is a YouTube person. I've no idea anything beyond that.
Okay, Iron Lung is this like cosmic horror sci-fi indie game. And basically Markiplier, because he has like the best YouTube money, essentially purchased the rights and self-financed a feature-length film written, directed, and starring himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because no distribution company would pick it up, he then distributed it himself in theaters, and with a $3 million budget, he's made back like $18 million
wow.
in profit. Which, you know, okay, has incredibly rabid fan base. But
right.
Also, you know what? Given that science fiction and horror are both genres where rampant ego projects lie, be it, say, The Room, the cinema of Neil Breen, the live-action movie of Battlefield Earth, or Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, put a pin in that for a few episodes' time, it's actually nice to see an ego project where it's actually good.
Wow.
Like, I was, okay, it is like, oh, wow, that Markiplier guy from the YouTubes can actually act and direct a film. There are, I would say, like the first half of the film was a bit slow, but honestly, it's a solid sci-fi genre film, very reminiscent to Event Horizon, and claims to have the most amount of fake blood ever used in a movie ever.
Even the Evil Dead.
Even more than actually the 2013 remake of The Evil Dead was the previous title owner, and it was 80,000 gallons US of fake blood.
Wow.
The best way to sum it up is blood, 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 and bits of sick. As you know, that famous quote from the other fantastic, egotistical horror creation, Garth Marenghi.
Nice. Yeah, I saw you make a post about Iron Lung and realized I had no idea what it is. And it's that thing of when you talk about that little money and that much profit return wise, and just going like, it'd be nice if some film companies actually remembered you can get a profit without having to get all of the profit.
Yeah, it was as I was telling Rihanna, it was just like, honestly, when it comes to a lot of films' budgets, like a lot of it is comes down to the advertising.
Mm.
Like I think that was why when Kevin Smith made Red State, he like did as little like all his promotion was basically using his platforms and word of mouth to promote the film, because the amount that these films usually apply in marketing is more than it costs to actually make the movie itself.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is a surprisingly solid film, and it's just like, yeah, I actually wish that studios would go, oh wait, we don't have to use the budget of Micronations to make a film which is, you know, going to make sufficient, you know, is going to make decent money, but because we spent three times the film's budget on marketing, it now has to make an obscene amount of money just to break even.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, for $3 million, the film looks good. Like the film looks good. Like it's a solid film. Surprisingly.
Cool.
And well, Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying this past week?
So I've been enjoying a podcast. Now, I'm a fan of the Trash Future podcast and their spin-off, Boney Island Whitefish, that talks exclusively about season 5 of Bones. And
why season five of Bones in particular?
Because you hit that point in a long running network show and the caring stops. It all gets weirder. The sensation is very much that they had 45 minutes to write it, as well as 45 minutes that the show needs to fill.
So the same energy that gives us Data's cat turning into a lizard and Picard running around spraying Troy pheromones.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing. And one of the hosts, November Kelly, has teamed up with Abigail Thorne from Philosophy Tube and another podcaster called Devon, who I can't remember what they do, but this kind of group have been doing a podcast called Kill James Bond. And I didn't bother with it at first, and they've started covering the Fast and Furious franchise. So I listened to the first two, enjoyed them, and went all the way back to Dr. No. And as of yesterday, I think I'm just done with Timothy Dalton. So, yeah, it's been a very enjoyable experience having a bit of a look in something I was a massive, massive fan of as a kid. Still kind of enjoy, but also has a lot of problems.
You want one of the annoying things about being... There are two annoying things about being an Englishman living in the US.
I mean, I'm sure there are so many more, but...
I mean, okay, fine. It's really hard to get a decent sausage in this country. Everyone kind of assumes that you're a fan of football. I am not. I'll support Brighton and Hove Albion because they're the home team. They started doing really well when I left the country, so I did choose to take that personally, the bastards. But everyone assumes I'm also a fan of James Bond, and that leads to situations where I end up bleeding from the eyeballs as I go, James Bond is a representation of everything I hate about British aristocracy and upper class imperialism. And while the films are enjoyable popcorn fluff, the novels by Ian Fleming are incredibly racist, sexist, and again, general British imperialism up the wazoo. And I'm sorry, I'm just not a fan. I can enjoy them, but I'm not a fan out of pure class protest.
Yeah, I get that. And yeah, this is like each film is rated on the scum system between 0 and 007 of smarminess, casual racism, unprovoked violence, and misogyny. And some, like Live and Let Die, managed to score like an 8 or a 9 on things like the racism.
I mean, I will say, you know, if you want me to enjoy a British spy series, then it has to have John Steed and Emma Peel and they have to be fighting eccentric spies in the home counties, and it just getting progressively weirder and more mind and more fetish material mined by Chris Claremont in his X-Men run.
Yes. Yeah. Good old Chris for that.
Although when it comes to Emma Peel as the Queen of Sin, I don't blame him. I really don't blame him.
Fair. Fair. Right. So, speaking of sinning, we shall continue to sin with the first episode of the day, which is Star Trek the Original Series, season 2, episode 16, titled A Private Little War. It aired on the 2nd of February 1968 with a teleplay by Gene Roddenberry, the story by Don Ingalls, writing under the pseudonym Judd Crucis, or Jesus Crucified, and directed by Mark Daniels. It's quite a pseudonym there.
That's amazing. Judd Crucis, that's amazing.
The number one hits in the UK was Simon Dupree and the Big Sound with Kites, and the US had John Fred and his Playboy Band with Judy in Disguise, open brackets, with glasses, close brackets.
I had never heard of either band. I've never heard of Simon Dupree, nor his Big Sound. I admit that one was pretty catchy and with some intense xylophone action.
I wasn't feeling it, to be honest.
That's fair. I think Judy in Disguise was a lot catchier, though. Although, I do, looking at the cover art, I do wish that his Playboy Band had been made up of, like, Playboy bunnies with brass band instruments, because that would be awesome.
It would be good. Yeah, it's definitely the catcher of the two, but one of those things of, like, I don't know, I never really got into either sound.
No, but you know what? Given that we have to deal with an Ed Sheeran number later on this episode, that's still less tedious, like Ed Sheeran.
This is true. Yes.
Ed Sheeran is sometimes like getting lime juice in a really bad cut on your finger.
Oh, so.
As a former bartender, I can tell you, lime juice in a cut is worse than lemon juice in a cut.
Okay, good. Good for the discerning, like, citrus cut people out there. Now you know. So, Miles, what's this episode about? And also, we should probably give a little warning up ahead as well.
Yep, this episode features scenes of sexual assault. And so, just be aware that that comes in.
And on that jolly note, you've got 5 minutes to recap this episode
of Gene Roddenberry's fetish book.
Yeah. So, begin.
Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are investigating an idyllic planet. Kirk was here back as lieutenant for his first planetary survey. He remembers it and the people as a paradise who are only hunting with bows and arrows. Oh, hey! There's some guys over there with flintlock pistols, dressed as Mongols, and they're hunting some guys with in buckskins and fantastically 80s hair. And those guys have bows and arrows. And wait, that's Kirk's old mate Tyree. Spock tells Kirk not to use phasers because this is one of those planets where Prime Directive rules definitely try and apply. So Kirk distracts him with a rock. Not a god-killing rock, just one of those fits snugly in the palm of your hand rocks. The three make their escape, but Spock gets fucking shot by a rifle as they beam out. McCoy and Chapel struggle to save Spock. A Klingon cruiser arrives in orbit, but they haven't spotted the Enterprise. The Enterprise hides out of the range of the Klingon ship sensors. Kirk believes they've broken the Orgonian Treaty, but Scotty claims that the Klingons could just be indulged in scientific research. But how has it taken the people of this planet to accomplish in 12 years what it took 12 centuries to do back on Earth and develop weapons? Oh, hey, it's Dr. Mbenga. They don't have the stuff they need to heal Spock. It's up to his own Vulcan strength. Kirk and McCoy plan to head back down to see if the Klingons are breaking the treaty by giving flintlock rifles to an innocent developing planet. Kirk unable to contact Starfleet is on his own judgment, but he's going to try his best not to interfere with the development. Oh, shit! Kirk gets fucking jumped by Mugato! A Mugato is basically a big white furry creature with a horn. I get the feeling that the costume was used in that episode where Shatner of the Twilight Zone sees a man on the wing of the plane. Bones is forced to phaser the Mugato, which has a poisonous bite. The Enterprise is out of range, and Bones has no anti-Mugato bite toxin. But Tyree's people have a cure. Found by Tyree's hill people, with the Mongol people being the village people, YMCA, they're taken to Tyree's settlement. McCoy's medical log tells us that how the hill people, despite their fear of the strangers, are good and compassionate. Tyree will return soon with Tyree's wife, Nona, and McCoy must keep Kirk alive. Out in the woods, Nona believes that they need the same weapons as the villagers, but Tyree believes that friendship will return between the two tribes in time. Nona is like from a different tribe, and she's seen as a witch woman. She's also ambitious and keeps Tyree under a spell with special leaves which have a mesmeric slash aphrodisiac effect on who she chooses. Back in the cave, McCoy uses his phaser to heat some nearby boulders to keep Kirk warm. Nona sees the phaser and demands Tyree tell her all about Kirk. Tyree is sworn to silence, but Nona withholds aid in exchange for the knowledge. Back on the Enterprise, Chapel holds Spock's hand tenderly while M'Benga tells her that Spock is conscious and that he probably even knows that he's holding her hand. Man, I bet these three people don't have any kind of previous kind of drama, tea or relationship stuff. Or that Chapel and Spock never hooked up in a spin-off show made like 50 years later and is kind of makes all the stuff a lot more awkward in context. Nona helps heal Kirk with a moving plant that looks like a little like a rubber poop, does a burlesque dance, and starts slapping the wound, which all has vaguely mystical overtones. Kirk lives! Yay! This means he gets to write all those Shatnerverse novels. Boo! Nona also mentions that her and Kirk's souls are joined, and that Kirk is hers now. Tyree claims that this ritual joins a man and a woman, and now Kirk cannot resist her commands. Nothing dodgy or suspicious here.
All right, Chris Claremont.
Recovering, Kirk and Tyree reunite happily, embracing like men. But when he lays eyes on Nona, Kirk is smitten by her, but tries not to let Tyree spot it. He wants to talk about the village people's new weapons. Nona is not subtle about her wishes, but Tyree tells her that the free will speak alone, like men. Spock's healing is going well. Kirk and McCoy are taken to the village to see how the weapons are being made, but just to be warned, Dumugato's mate is nearby and is searching for them. Nona tells Kirk that he will make Tyree a man of great importance, and that Tyree has told Nona everything about where Kirk and McCoy actually come from, and that she wants...
Time's up. Gonna have to administer some more weird rubber poop drug.
Okay, just don't slap the wound, please.
And continue.
Tyree has told Nona everything about where Kirk and McCoy actually come from, and she wants weapons better than the rifles. But Kirk tells her that while he's grateful, he cannot affect the development of Tyree's people because of the Prime Directive, even if Tyree dies because of it. But Tyree has faith in his good friend, Jimmy T, and McCoy is confident that if they find out the Klingons are behind this, they can sort this all out. But Kirk is worried that he may have no other way but to help give Tyree the tools to defend themselves, even if Tyree's people feel just as strongly about peace and non-violence as they do. In the village, the Klingon Krell gives Appella, the village people's leader, a new and improved rifle, while Kirk and McCoy are doing a little Metal Gear Solid and had discovered a forge and the tools to build the rifles. But they've also discovered evidence to implicate the Klingons. If only they had a live Klingon, better be careful what you wish for, guys, as Krell and Appella enter the forge, and our heroes are caught, but they make a quick escape along with a stolen rifle. Back on the Enterprise, Spock orders Chapel to hit him to help return him to consciousness. Scotty comes in as Chapel is slapping Spock around the face, but M'Benga rushes in and starts smacking Spock in the face himself. Calm down! Calm down! Calm down! Spock is now back and fighting fit. Charlie.
Yeah.
You know how I often talk about how a lot of Spock and Chapel stuff in TOS is now a lot more awkward because of what goes down in Strange New Worlds?
Yeah.
This is the reverse, because this is all a lot funnier if you take Strange New Worlds into context. You know, definitely. Chapel just remembers that she did a whole Taylor Swift breakup song with Spock that one time they're all doing musical numbers, and is just smacking him in the face. And then Begin remembers all the shit and probably thinks that Spock has it coming, like the musical Chicago. Kirk teaches Tyree and the Hill people how to use the rifles, much to McCoy's disdain. Bad enough that there's one serpent in Eden. Do they have to have two? Kirk feels that if both sides are equal, then the planet's natural development should kind of work itself out. McCoy is worried that Nona does have, like, influence over Kirk, but Kirk is determined not to give them advanced weapons. McCoy is worried that they're both condemning this planet to never-ending war. McCoy has no solution, and Kirk reminds him of the 20th century brush wars where various Asian countries were armed by two great superpowers as proxies, with neither side feeling that they could pull out, but instead to keep arming the people. Psst! He's talking about Vietnam!
Oh!
It's a metaphor for Vietnam!
Oh, wow.
And also a very metaphor for capitalism. Kirk feels that there has to be a balance of power, and frankly not a balance of terror. That's a much better episode. And if the Klingons give the villagers better arms, then they'll have no choice but to do the same. And Kirk will try and explain this to Tyree. But, says McCoy, since Tyree won't fight, but he'll be the first to die. But maybe if Kirk gets Nona to do it, she can kind of explain it to Tyrell. War may not be a good life, but at least it's life. Now, no, a good life is when a young Billy Mumy has psychic powers and everyone has to be happy or he'll wish them into the cornfield. It's a Twilight Zone episode. The Simpsons parodied it in a Treehouse of Horror one time. Kirk spies Nona bathing. Ah, said Nona, I commanded you here. Nona pulls out the special herbs to make Kirk horny for her, and Tyree spies the two of them together as Kirk and Nona start kissing. This episode would go a lot differently if Tyree were actually into that. But Federation and Klingon cuckchairs aren't as advanced as the Romulan cuckchair, as well we all know in this show. Tyree aims his rifle at Kirk, plans to kill him for macking on his missy, but he lowers the rifle in disgust, not wishing to kill. Instead, he throws the rifle away and runs off. And then the Mugatos make fucking attacks! Kirk is too bewitched by Nona, and in desperation, he phases the Mugato. Nona conks Kirk on the head with a rock and steals his phaser. Nona rushes to the villagers, planning to secure her position by giving Appella the powerful weapon to rule this world. Because, you know, women, am I right, apparently, Gene Roddenberry. The villagers she stumbles across decide instead that they're going to assault Nona. Kirk, McCoy, and Tyree arrive, but the villagers stab Nona. Tyree and Kirk leap into the fight. McCoy has been wounded and just watches helplessly from the sidelines as Tyree bludgeons a villager to death with a big rock. Not a god-killing rock, but a peace-killing rock. Now, Tyree has learned how to kill. Nona is dead, and Tyree demands that Kirk gives him more rifles. He will now kill the village people for what he has done. McCoy has the phaser, telling Kirk that Kirk got what he wanted. Kirk tells McCoy that this isn't what he wanted, and Kirk asks Scotty to make 100 flintlock rifles, calling them serpents for the Garden of Eden. Kirk and McCoy are tired and just want to go home.
Wow, that is 5 minutes and 46 seconds. Subtle. But also incredibly confused.
Yes.
So, Miles, why did the Klingons do any of this?
I assumed that they basically want to do this to get more control over the planet and, like, the village people, and thus its resources. I think it's like, hey, so I think doesn't Krell, who appears in one scene, kind of explained to Appella that he'll be a governor of a Klingon-run world. So I assume that, you know, he basically gives Appella the weapons he needs. Appella kills Hill people. Klingons get planet?
It would have been nice to know if there were, like, resources or something, like some objective for the Klingons here, or if Krell was working alone in doing this as well. Because I hit a point of writing in my notes, for a Klingon episode, there aren't many Klingons, just before Krell appeared.
It's kind of, it's one of those things we have to take into context, that the Klingons we kind of know traditionally as the bloodwine warrior honor maniacs aren't really a thing in TOS, where they're definitely more kind of, they're vaguely Eastern imperialist, yellow peril, Fu Manchu tash wearing types in space.
Yeah, and there, like, sometimes you get a little bit of crossover with the modern Klingons of going, look, honor is fine as long as you win. Like, cheating and winning is not too bad, actually. Like, as long as you actually get what you want. And, so we're back to the blackface, of course.
We're back to the brownface, not just with Krell.
No,
but also with the with the actress who is playing Nona,
Nancy Kovac.
Yes,
Nona, who is apparently was told to be kind of a bit Romani with it as well. Which again, it's like, oh God, right, we're really dialing up a bit of the racism here, and seeing pictures of Nancy Kovac, she's definitely been hitting the fake tan a bit.
Yeah.
For her work as Nona. Also, she's shaved a bit of gritty and wearing it as a top.
Apparently, Shatner and Kovac dated briefly in the 60s.
Ah, okay.
But, you know what?
Mm.
Watching this episode makes me glad that for the most part, Doctor Who, it usually keeps a lot of the, kind of sexist and racist eras, attitudes of the time, very much not in the show, because it's a kid show. And usually the amount of sexism you get is basically it is having a character who's very much portrayed as a strong independent woman of the 60s or 70s. And then I watched this, I'm like, oh dear God, sometimes I don't give Doctor Who enough credit, because you know what, it's been a while since we've had an episode of Star Trek be both incredibly sexist and racist in good measure.
I mean, with this, like, so was Nona just in it for vague power?
I don't know.
I'm gonna give this phaser to.
I mean, at first I thought it was like this. She was kind of doing like a Lady Macbeth and kind of trying to egg on Tyree to get ? Power, and then I guess when Kirk utterly fails to kind of defeat the Mugato, and she just decides, sod it, I'm switching sides. That's not going to go wrong.
Yeah, one, taking the phaser, which apparently she can't work as well. Of like, how difficult must it be? Like, the amount of time that she gets of pressing the button while being assaulted, you would expect her to accidentally hit the right button.
I mean, maybe like there's a safety catch.
Maybe
phasers in Star Trek work like the Lawgivers in Judge Dredd, or the guns in Blake 7, which identify the handprint of the person wielding it.
Yeah, although I'd feel that would be in the text if that was the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're having to do this episode's work for it.
I mean, let's be honest, it's the 60s, it's Gene Roddenberry. It might just boil down to, women don't know how to use gun. Gun is man work.
Yes, so I'd be too busy thinking about kittens.
Yes. I mean, to be fair, I would love to think about kittens or to live long day.
Fair. Okay.
I mean, I do want to say the hill people have fantastic 80s hair.
They were like, what if the Children of the Damned grew up? It was incredible. And then, yeah, then the waistcoats that they put Kirk and Bones in as well. It's
The full-on buckskins. Like, I guess, I mean, they apparently they have, like, costume stores for a lot of these various planets. So it's like, okay, all right, bring out, let's all dress as Native Americans for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. God. This episode, like, it sounds like it was a mess behind the scenes as well.
Apparently the writer wanted it more blatant than this is an allegory for Vietnam. It's just like, it's already pretty kind of blatant as is.
Well, yeah, I think Roddenberry tried tuning it down a bit, and I've seen many essays online talking about how it kind of ends up going a little bit, well, could be read a little bit the other way, or a bit patronizingly of, oh yes, these people were innocent naives who, you know, were given weapons by an evil force and all that. It's these magical foreigners.
These magical foreigners from Eastern non-democratic ways have come to corrupt the, oh dear God, it's a colonialism.
Yeah.
And it ends with Kirk very much not doing a Starfleet.
They just go.
Yeah. Just
like, fuck, we've had enough of this. This is a bit too complex for us. Bye.
I get why it's very blatant, why they have to kind of write Spock out for the episode. Mm. Because, you know, this entire episode would go a lot differently if Spock were around. He's like, no.
Yeah, Bones isn't at his best here.
No. I mean, you know, it's also kind of interesting to see what happens to, like, the holy trinity of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy when Spock is completely taken out of the equation and you have the emotional one and Kirk on an adventure together.
Yeah, God, and Spock getting shot, like, the reaction, like, the fall he took, very good. The light dusting of green paint on both sides of his top, very poor. There were some very bad, like, fights in this. The impacts from a lot of them, stabbings with zero blood, which, you know, I get it, but also obscure the stabbing then.
Yeah. You know, don't lightly scrape the knife across someone's back. Just do it. Like, you have, this is why you have fake stage knives to do. Yeah. The actual stabbing.
Hell, they even have a fun moment where it cuts shockingly quickly as Nona's about to brain Kirk with a rock. It's like, oh, that's an interesting cut. And yeah, no, it's very, very little's done with it.
I like how the Mugatu just appears.
Yes.
It's like this creature just teleports.
Oh, he's back. Yes, this mating pair of Mugatu, which hopefully aren't extinct now because of this.
No, because there's some turn up in that one episode of Lower Decks.
Oh, yes.
Where they make fun of the different pronunciations.
Yeah, which, yeah, I assume is a nod to the fact that it was going to be the Gamato, but DeForest Kelly kept mispronouncing it, so they decided to go with his version instead. Which, yeah, fair. Like, yeah. It's not like it appeared beforehand or anything.
We
make shit up.
Wait. You can make shit up in science fiction. Wait. You don't have to have detailed lore. You could just make shit up.
I mean, where do you think it all comes from?
I assume a mail order service.
Oh no, has someone got to you? Is someone conning you and posting you things from Synecdoche or somewhere?
Is actually Synecdoche, New York, but yes.
Synecdoche, I've never heard it pronounced out loud.
I don't know how to pronounce it. I just came up with this off the top of my head. I just made it. Oh!
Fuck! Oh my God!
You could just make shit up!
Wow!
So, okay. Quick question.
Yep.
Is it more sexist or more racist? I don't know.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult. I mean, like, again, I think we're reading Gene Roddenberry's dream journal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that said, while you do have the hill people and the village people fighting one another and the obvious Vietnam allegories, which are, again, a little strained in the rewrites, you don't have an assault on... You know, to the level of what happens with Nona, who did do some things wrong. Don't get it mixed up. But also, yeah, like a protracted fight where some men are trying to assault her while she's trying to make the phaser work, and then it stops because she dead. Like,
yeah,
that's not good.
And now Tyree is ready to kill because, you know, it's not that they've been killing his men. It's not that they've been killing, like, his people or hunting them down. It's because they killed his wife. It's just like, nope. Well, I'm going to go Charles Bronson on these bastards.
Yeah. It's not great. Yeah.
I will give the episode credit. Like, it does have a very kind of just... It's actually a very sour note ending. I guess you kind of think that, like, Star Trek, they're gonna find a way, or just like Kirk is gonna speechify. It's just like, we're posting a report to Starfleet with many addendums and many, many edits.
Yeah, it's. I don't know, it could have been a better downer ending. It feels somewhat akin to the ones who walk away from the child killing machine in that respect, where they've gone, fuck it, I guess we arm them and leave. Fuck it all.
And here's the point where just like Kirk and McCoy's watches go off and like, alright, okay, time, let's wrap this up. We gotta get out of here.
Yeah, we couldn't deal with this in 40 minutes, so fuck it, I guess.
I guess we've condemned this idyllic planet to war.
And that said, one positive I found was I was laughing all through the slapping Spock scene, where it's like, you know, when Nurse Chapel is talked around to it and starts slapping him, and it's like, no, harder. And after Scotty stops, it's like, yeah, alas, Chapel couldn't bring him off. It took Mbenga to come along and finish the job. It's like, yeah, you can see Spock is... as much as he can be relieved there. It's like, oh no, has he come?
I love the point when I know Scotty just walks in, I guess, for some aspirin. Yeah. And he's just like, what the hell?
Yeah. And that said, like Strange New Worlds Chapel would definitely be fine with like attacking beating someone about the head. To try and cure them of something.
Like, the scene I couldn't help but think of, and I sent you the video, is the scene from Airplane.
Yeah.
The lady gets hysterical, and everyone's like, God, I've got this, calm down. Like,
yeah, I do wonder if Leonard Nimoy was just tickled by the whole thing, because he did seem in a good mood after the slapping. Oh, God. That said... as a whole, this was not a good mood episode. We should probably think about where we put it on our big list. And we are now on the road to 200. We have 192 entries on our big list of Star Trek films and episodes. Our number one spot, of course, goes to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, the 50th. Here is Starfleet Academy with a beta test, which, yeah, nice new entry there. 100 has Where Silence Has Lease with the big weird face in space. 150 is Move Along Home.
Alamarain!
Yes, and then 192 is, of course, multiple Razzie nominee Star Trek Section 31, as questionable as the Razzies are, and some of the choices of candidates for it. It's like, it's a shit movie. Michelle Yeoh did not need that on her.
No. Like, you know, it's... Yeah. I mean, there are many bad things I can say about the Razzies.
Mm.
But this is definitely... But, like, Michelle Yeoh, even if I don't like the Philippa Georgiou character, she's still putting it... She's still, like, giving a good performance.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I'm looking pretty low down on this list.
Yeah, I mean... Oh, God.
We've got a couple of the worst Tribble entries, with Tribble Called Quest and More Trouble, More Tribbles. At 171 and 172, I feel those are probably better than this.
I mean, I am looking down lower. I am looking at 186, which is the high ground, which is another time where Star Trek tries to tell us how various wars are bad, but this one tries to do it. It tries to be vaguely about the IRA, and then completely bollocks it straight away.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think, like, underneath it at 187, we've got the Pilot of Picard, which isn't good. But yeah, I think this is probably worse than the High Ground, because the High Ground is, sure is, you know, pretty racist, but is not sexist.
No. And I would say there is some good there is some good Shatner acting, and not shacting Shatner acting, like, you know, like Shatner is still committed.
I mean, when he is transfixed with Nona, there are some questionable shots and close ups of him, which Emma walked in from doing a jigsaw just at the moment he was kind of almost vibrating with lust. After Nona had, like, waved some basil or something in his face. Which, don't get me wrong, I like basil. I like a good pesto, but this is, yeah, that's a bit much.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Not as good as the high, worse than the High Ground, but better than Remembrance.
Cool. Okay. So that's our new 187. Incredible. It's been a little while since we've had something that low.
I mean, it's still better than Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, but then again, having heart failure is better than Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, and I should know.
Well, yeah. Yeah, this is, the voice of experience. So, next up.
Charlie?
Yo?
Before we start this episode, can I quickly say something?
Mm-hmm.
Candyman? 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 Candyman?
Is it five times? I thought it was three.
No, that's three times is Beetlejuice.
Oh, I've still not seen Candyman.
Oh, man. Candyman is great.
I bought it when we were talking about doing a Tony Todd episode and then did not watch it.
It's a good film. The recent reboot was actually also very good. And also, yeah, I get to do this and have it be legitimate and not just my usual psychotic coffee-induced ravings.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, it's one of the few horror films which my partner has seen, but I haven't. Which normally it's very much the other way around.
Oh, it's definitely the other way around where I'm concerned.
Yeah, so on that note... Our second episode is Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 3, Episode 17, titled Sins of the Father. This aired on the 19th of March 1990, with a teleplay by a very young Ron Moore and W. Reed Moran, story by Drew Dayan, and directed by Les Landau. The UK number one hit was Beats International with Dub Be Good To Me, and the US had Janet Jackson with Escapade. And Dub Be Good To Me was one of those ones I know, but I never knew the name of.
Okay, first of all, what I had to say about Dub Be Good To Me is that I'm sorry, I'm more of a sub Be Good To Me. And any song which samples Ennio Morricone from Once Upon a Time in the West is a good song.
Yes.
But... Also, this has a bit of local flavor for both you and me, because this was written by Norman Fatboy Slim Cook.
Oh, God. Wow. pretty sure he lived near me at one point.
What, trying to score drugs off the level?
I mean, maybe. Who knows? Yeah, and the Janet Jackson one, yeah. Like, there are some of her songs that I like, but yeah, this was pretty meh.
There's some fantastic dancing, though, in the video.
Some very good dancing. It did feel like everyone dress up. I will not dress up from Janet Jackson. And you got to admire that.
I will be the most well-dressed person here by putting in the least effort.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone else can dress all kind of nonsensical or like, yeah, film characters, but not well. And I will just be classy. So yeah, that's how you get in charge of that kind of a set.
Yeah. So, Charlie.
Yes.
Are you ready to recount the sins of the father?
Yes. First of all, my father did send me and my brother into the woods at one point and said we had to find a bunker or some kind of shelter to hide because the Hulk was coming to kill us. And then he left. Do you mean the episode Sins for Father?
Yes.
Cool.
I will act as your Chadich.
Ah.
You know, and Chadich, got ya. But, you know, we have 5 minutes to do this, or we will be ritualistically put to death.
Oh, fuck.
I know. So we're going to be ritualistically put to death. I know how long these things go with you.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, it's going to happen at some point.
All right. Okay, fine. And Kapla.
Kapla! Right, it's time for another Klingon exchange program. Things went so well with Riker, so this time it's going to be fine, right? Wrong! Tony Todd plays Commander Kern, and he hates everything he sees. He immediately gets on the job, and he's not going to take any nonsense from these people. Riker's off the clock in 10 forward, just chilling. And Wesley whines to him about being belittled by Kern. Then Geordi shows up to whine about being belittled by Kern. He's doing this to everyone, apart from Worf, who's getting patronizingly nice treatment. Riker offers Kern a bit of help adapting to the Enterprise's ways, and he says he has already, otherwise he'd have killed Riker for offering to help. Kern gets invited into a buffet dinner. Try the caviar. It's old JL's favourite. He doesn't like the caviar. He doesn't like the replicated bird meat. The food is too bland. And Geordi says, Worf likes it fine, which, Geordi, you are not helping in this moment. This is only going to increase the bullying. Worf visits Kern, who bitches about his quarters. Worf wants to know if he offended Kern in some way, and kind of. Like, Kern thinks that Worf is weak, and they're about to kick off in a fight. Kern is pleased with this. It's what he'd want to see from his older brother? Oh my god, soap operatic twist!
What a twist!
Oh! Kern was 1 year old and left with a friend by his parents, and it was assumed he'd died on Kittimer and was raised separately from them. He wanted to see what Worf was like and if he could defend himself at their dad's trial, which is going to happen posthumously for aiding the Romulans in the attack that killed Worf's dad and a lot of other people as well. Worf asks for some time off to pursue this whole thing, and Picard's like, no, mate, this is Enterprise business now. Change course, Kern. Kern's pretty happy about this, actually, and accepts a role as Worf's Chadich. His second, basically. Worf says Kern should keep his lineage secret, you know, just for his safety. We get our first ever view of Kronos. It's all stormy and ominous. Kempek, which is not a file format, calls up Duras, who's the one making the accusation. Picard's here and has read the room, so he communicates mostly by shouting. They adjourn for the day. Kerplur. On the Enterprise, Picard gets his finest nerds on the job of researching this whole situation. Kempek has a word with Worf and says he shouldn't really have any challenge. Like, he shouldn't have challenged this. He'd have been safe with the Federation. Now his life is at stake. Worf doesn't want to back down, though. He's proper Klingon, despite what everyone and the graffiti in the loo says. Kern meets Duras, who knows his parentage, and has him stabbed. It's pretty bad, but he will heal. And JL now needs to take on the role of Chadich. Data mentions that the Klingons captured a Romulan ship and found this data, which is why it all led back to Worf's dad. But there's a suspicious gap in the information. Someone's been tampering with it, and Klingon accountants, they're a bit of a rarity. JL mentions that someone's been hiding something. No one expected Worf to act like a Klingon, and it's shaken everything up. Court in session! Duras tries to big dog JL for being Chadich, but he's not having it. He's called mid-troll and told, hey, there's a woman who survived alongside Worf, called Callist. JL calls a recess and runs off to find her. She's in the old quarter and says she can't help. She's been a long time dead, officially. Was Worf's dad a traitor? No. He suspected plotting, and that's why they went to Kittimer, and he died there. Of course, JL is ambushed and holds his own at first, but needs some help from Callist. And sure, fine, now she'll join him and shake the truth loose. The trial begins, and they go for a sidebar immediately with Kempek and Duras, who instantly shows that he's guilty as all hell, and worse, Kempek knows and doesn't give a shit. The truth all comes loose. Duras' dad was the traitor, and everyone in the High Council knows, but it'd ruin things if anything got public, so they decided to shame Worf's dad, as Worf wouldn't be affected. He's safely with the Federation. No harm, no foul. But he had to go and do the Klingon thing, and also have a secret brother. And he's
right. Charlie, you have failed. No. I will now have to turn my back on you. Now let that be a lesson to you.
Okay, thank you. I think I can just about live with that. So,
and go.
There has to be a solution to this, and Worf says the easiest one, worse than death, because death is on the line at this point for Worf. If he fucks this up, is to get Klingon excommunicated. His brother's going to remain hidden and his family shamed. And this way, he doesn't need to die, and Kern can secretly pursue their honor. Kern agrees to this, and the Klingons literally turn their backs to Worf in an amazing moment that goes on way too long, but beautiful. Defeated, Worf leaves with his space dad. The end.
Charlie.
Yo.
Do you know what Quark has done that puts him one over on Worf?
Oh?
In the Klingon Game of Thrones, he got someone else to have their backs turned on them, and yeah. Worf didn't.
Oh, Worf. It's probably best that Quark never found out about this, because otherwise he'd never let Worf live it down.
Oh, 44 seconds.
Nice. So, yeah, this was very good fun. This definitely feels like it solidifies these are the Shakespearean shouty men of space.
This is proper space opera.
Hell yeah.
Like Star Trek, TNG, I feel, does more like big concept SF than space opera. But like, we're here. There's great empires. There's court intrigue. There's people wearing cloaks and carrying knives. It's all very Dune.
Yeah, or like some of the shadier areas in Babylon 5.
Yeah.
You've got space corridors, but still robed people with daggers.
Okay, I love the fact that Kern turns up, takes command, looks at Wesley Crusher, and basically goes, I will kill you first.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite of that, go to prison, fight the biggest person you can see to establish dominance. Kurt is like, no, I'm going to fight the smallest, weakest one of you.
We're going to do this like in high school. We're going to find the most pathetic, weak-looking nerd on a ship of nerds, and we're just going to bully him.
I did like the, almost to back up the fact that Wesley was whining to Riker. It's like, that's not good enough, because let's face it, he'd whine to anyone about anything, but Geordi's here as well. also having a bit of a moan about how shit everything is under Kern.
You know what would have made this episode like 20 times better? If Wesley just jumped Kern. just started ineffectually slapping him.
Oh! just thrown down the corridor, just not...
just
what is this insect?
Just runs down the corridor screaming and flailing his arms, and then jumps Kern, and thus earns Kern's respect.
Ooh, wow.
He'd be like, small human, I like you. I will kill you last. The Forge!
You are next on the list.
Geordi, you have now been up to I will kill you first.
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing of Kern felt like almost the worst TNG stereotype of course he almost irrationally hates any thought or logic or anything at all the moment he arrives. But when it's like, oh no, he's mostly doing this to Big Dog, his brother, and to go like, you know, Worf, turn on me. Just at any point, I want proof that you can fight, because our dad's getting posthumous trialed.
They immediately become the Mitchell boys in space.
Oh, it's great. The moment that it turns, and it's like, yeah, okay, you're getting a smile from Kern. This is good. You've earned this.
Look,
and
we
have done so good in it.
Oh, yeah. He's fantastic as Kern.
Yeah, it's such a shit. And then, yeah, his help with the whole court case thing, and like he doesn't want to be just quietly I am nondescript Chadic. He wants to be out there, and Worf managing to get him to back down and be like, no mate, you're dead. If this goes wrong, you're dead, and you know, you could pursue honor and revenge and all that if you are alive as you are.
Do you want to hear my headcanon theory about the writing of this episode?
Mm.
That originally was probably going to be like Riker who becomes like Worf's Kadeech, but Patrick Stewart storms into the writing room and went, "You're doing Shakespeare without old Patty Stew. I won't allow it."
God, yeah. There are a number of people that would be a more fitting Kadeech as far as the martial side of things for Worf, but you have to get your big Shakespearean shouter.
Oh, yeah, like, he must be so happy to get some proper shouting.
Like, the moment he arrives, it's like, he's got this. He knows this. He is a much smaller, like, white, bald man who is in every way, like, smaller than every single person here. Like, even Kempek, who feels a little, you know, a little doughier as a Klingon noble. Even he could take JL.
Oh, I mentioned Magic because just like in the transporter room, just practicing his shouting.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Kempek, he feels like a good choice of Klingon judge. Of like, yeah, this guy, he's, what is it, Charles Cooper, does a good... Like, yeah, I'm a warrior, but I'm a bit fat and decadent. Like, his kapler is just kapler. It's...
What's the name of the king from the first season of Game of Thrones?
Oh, Bobby Boy.
Yeah, it's Robert Baratheon. Like, he had, like... okay, the bit I loved was with the nursemaid. Mm. And he was just like, oh, man, I was hot for her, but she thought I was fat. And they reunite, and he has that moment where he's just like, It's really good to see you again. I am old and fat. She just looks at me and goes, yeah, you're still fat, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He still can't pull.
No. Oh, man. You know, seriously, like, again, as a fan of space opera, like, you don't get enough, like, in TNG, where you have like your main character sneaking down to like the dark parts of the city to find someone who knows the secret lineage. Like Patrick, like Picard is like Ned Starking his way around Konos.
Slightly more successfully than old Ned.
Yeah. Or just like, again, for another bit of Patrick, like joyful Patrick Stewart acting, when it all clicks for Picard and he realizes that Duras is manipulating the house, like, aha, I've got it! It's you!
Yes, he does a very good job of being like, oh my god, you are all shit. Like, all of you. You all know this. And Worf, bless him, he does a good job with this, but he does not have the finesse to be able to go, oh, like, they're playing us all, and if I freak out, that's going to play into their hands.
Picard's like, wait a minute, you all suck!
Which, yes, they do.
This is definitely the beginning of a long line of moments in Worf's life when it's just going to be, yup, you are going to have to dishonor yourself for the Klingon greater good.
Yeah, it's good fun, though. Like, apparently it is the thing that got Michael Dorn's perception of Worf to kind of crystallize and go, this is how we're playing it, and really develop as a person, as a Klingon from here, which, given this is one of Ron Moore's earliest scripts as well, it's like, yeah, guy did good. Like, he got help. Like, he needed help, because he not only was new to it, but he had to combine two different spec scripts into one with it. And yeah, guy's going places.
For all mankind, really. A show I keep meaning to watch.
Same. I've never got round to. Like, it sounds like it's pretty good.
It sounds pretty good, but again, I think it's we just might be too British for that.
Yes.
Because we're just kind of like, they're doing like, what if the space race continued? And then we're here trying to pitch a show to like the BBC going, what if the British had a space program? Hear me out. I mean, okay, we did this back in the 60s, in the 50s with the Quatermass experiment, and it's kind of cute how in the Pertwee era, we've made multiple trips to Mars. But can we have a show where the British have a space program?
No, apparently.
No. No, that's too out there for for British science fiction.
Definitely. Oh god, yeah, you know it would be PFI'd to hell.
Yeah. But yeah, like this is a good episode.
This is.
I'm not like the hugest fan of the Klingons, but I do like the political intrigue. It immediately makes me think of Babylon 5, where it's just like, we're just going to have like a very cheap looking stage play while great houses are kind of doing their shit.
Yeah. Question is, where on earth does this go on our list?
Okay. So do you think that this is a top 20?
It's a very good one.
Like, it's a good one. This pretty much solidifies the Klingon. This is like the urtext for how Klingons are going to be going forward.
Yeah, like, it's got no Gowron, which is a mark against it, I will say.
Chrono set, it has the Mighty Boosh, everyone turns their back on Worf.
Hilarious. Love it.
It has Worf, who earnestly just wants to, like, do what his race does and gets shat on at every turn.
Oh, god, yeah. Like, yeah, it is one of those. He is the decent one in this and proves that he is Klingon.
Worf immediately loses the Game of Thrones.
Yeah. I mean, let's see. I know we've got House of Quark up at 12, but looking a bit further down, like, if we're saying top 20, we've got Yesterday's Enterprise in the 20th spot. I mean, it's difficult because that is very good fun. It's a weird beast of an episode, but
which one? Yesterday's Enterprise or The Sins of the Father?
Yesterday's Enterprise.
Yeah. Below. Okay. I really don't want to go beyond above Yesterday's Enterprise, because that's number 19 is Necessary Evil, which like one of my favorite episodes of DS9. It's the Odo does a film, does a Chinatown. So at episode 21, we have Sarek, which also has some a lot more scene chewing from Patrick Stewart.
I don't know. I think this might be better than Sarek. Like, both are really good case studies of their respective species.
Yeah.
But again, Sarek don't turn his back on on Picard.
And also, do you know what Sarek doesn't have? Picard getting into a fucking knife fight.
Yeah. God, yeah, again, P-Stew must have been very happy with getting to do a bit of a knife fight.
Oh man, like I really want Picard to just kind of go full prison and go, I'm going to knife you. I'm going to cut you, bitch.
I mean, look, we know he certainly will have done that before.
Yeah, like, we know Picard is a bit of a rebel rouser, but we also know that Picard himself is also a terrible actor. So you want to feel that his trying to be tough is just going to be really bad.
Yes. Okay, so, what, sticking this at our number 21.
Yes.
I love how, like, this is really high up. Previous one, really low down. Yeah, I don't know if we've had this bipolar a set of episodes for a while.
I mean, that's the fun of the show.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, I'm still trying to think what's going to knock Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. Well, and what's going to knock Section 31? Like, you know, taking all comers for both best and worst here.
I don't know, how racist do we need to go?
Oh, God. I mean, we've still not dared touch Code of Honor.
No.
Or any of the times that they've tried to do Native Americans. Yeah.
I mean, beyond the one we did, beyond the episode we did earlier. Oh, do you mean, like, when they try and do a very special episode with Chakotay?
I mean, that too, yeah. Yeah. So, our final episode is Star Trek Lower Decks Season 2, Episode 9, Wedge Douche, which also kind of means Free Ships. This aired on the 7th of October 2021, written by Catherine Lynn and directed by Bob Suarez. The UK number one hit was Nemesis of the Pod, Ed Sheeran, with Shivers, and the US had The Kid Laroi and Justin Bieber with Stay. Fucking Ed Sheeran, man.
I mean, all I have to say about Stay is that the sound cut out on YouTube 30 seconds in, and I was just like, you know what? Probably for the best.
Yeah, it's not as bad as Shivers, but it's not good. I think, for me, the track of this evening was Dub Be Good to Me, really. Ed Sheeran's, though, was one of those, no matter what the video did, no matter what the lyrics said, he is just at a neutral, ambient, kind of emotional nothing.
I mean, like, I think the thing we find so offensive about Ed Sheeran is that he's just so inoffensive.
Mm.
Also, any song which makes me think of the David Cronenberg body horror film Shivers deserves my disdain, because I would rather be watching a Canadian horror film where a mad scientist creates a parasite which makes everyone who is infected by it horny, violent, and with syphilis, and have it just permeate through this tower block.
Oh, God, I think I might have seen that one. I was going to say pretty standard Cronenberg, but yeah.
It's not the one High-Rise based off the Ballard novel.
No, which is also very good.
I've not seen the film. I've read the novel a few times.
Film is good. Ben Wheatley is also writing a 2000 AD strip currently.
Oh, how is that going?
Very good fun. It's a buddy cop thing between a side judge and a demon that's possessed her.
Interesting.
Yes, very good fun.
But yeah, I do recommend Shivers. Content warning. It's David Cronenberg at like his early body horror period, so be careful.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the Cronenberg I've seen with the tower block stuff, but yes. Anyway, what we've also seen is Lower Decks. So this is a shorter clock, of course, and let's see, what can we get up to with these three ships? Kapla!
Kapla! The Cerritos is beginning a 12-hour warp to begin a survey mission, and Soda Crew is on downtime. Boiler wants to hang out, but Mariner, Rutherford, and Tendi are all spending time with members of the bridge crew. Boiler's like, no, I wish I had a bridge buddy. But also, can you imagine what it'd be like to be a lower decker on a Klingon ship? On the Chitauri, a Klingon ship, we meet some Klingon lower deckers, including Ma'a, who is going to be helmsman for today. He has heard that Commander Tog is going to try and kill Captain Dorg, and he wants to hang around just in case that he gets picked to be the new number one. Ma'a arrives just as Tog is getting knifed in the fucking throat by Dorg, and Dorg makes him his new helmsman. Also, he is on Targ duty today. Meanwhile, we cut to a Vulcan ship, the Cheval, and we get to meet some Vulcan lower deckers, including, hey, wait, that's Talyn. She's going to be a recurring character in seasons 4 and 5. Talyn is kind of a high functioning Vulcan and is pissing off all the other Vulcans because she's like, hey, I keep having initiative. And all the Vulcans are like, yeah, shit, no, initiative bad. You're really emotional. God, I want to meet a Vulcan Karen. I bet they're the worst. Talyn's senses have picked up this strange anomaly, and she convinces the captain to go investigate. Boimler's attempts to get a bridge buddy aren't going so well. He pisses off T'Ana. He pisses off Shax. He gets into the holodeck with Mariner and Captain Freeman talking about Mariner's periods. Get out of that one. Instead, he runs into Ransom and Ransom's mates, who all claim to be from Hawaii. Is Boimler going to start a web of lies? Why, yes, he is. And claims he's from Hawaii. Back on the Klingon ship, Ma'a has earned Dorg's respect by lamenting the old days, and it turns out that Dorg is doing something very underhanded in a kind of Krell kind of way. So you know how, like, there has been the season 1 or 2 kind of arc about the Pakleds being well-armed? Yeah, it turns out that Dorg is the one who's been giving the Pakleds weapons, including a bomb, which the Pakleds want a replacement bomb because they blew up a moon to see how it works. And it turns out that's what's created these strange readings that are drawing the Cerritos and the Vulcan ship to their location. Dorg decides, fuck it, I'm going all in. We're going to attack the Federation ship when the Cerritos arrives. Attacks both the Cerritos and the Vulcan ship. Ma'a is like, there is no honor in this, and throws down with Dorg. They fight. Dorg gets the other hand, but Dorg makes the mistake of kicking around his Targ, who is a good boy, a good Klingon space doggo, and he helps Ma'a get the other hand, and Ma'a kills Dorg and becomes captain of the ship. Meanwhile, on the Vulcan ship, Talyn saves the day by increasing the shield output, thus protecting the Vulcan ship. On the Cerritos, the web of lie, Boimler's web of lies comes crashing down almost immediately. But also, everyone was lying about being from Hawaii. They're all from moons, and they just wanted to hang out with Ransom because Ransom's from Hawaii and cool. Now, Ransom's also from the moon. He just lied about it to impress his captain. Boimler tries to hop in on this, and he fails almost immediately because he's from Modesto, California, which apparently is very dry as California goes. The day is saved, and now the Cerritos knows that why the Pakleds are well-armed is actually Dorg. Talyn is taken to the Vulcan captain, and for her emotional outbursts, of which there have been very few from our point of view, she's actually going to get sent to Starfleet. I wonder if that's going to, you know, shake up the status quo of the show in a couple of seasons' time in the Cerritos bar. You know, Boimler doesn't get a bridge buddy, but he gets sent a young ensign his way by Ransom for help, just help in just organizing stuff. And hey, what's it like to be a Borg lower decker? Well, we cut to a Borg ship in the Delta Quadrant, and while a bunch of Borg recharge while the credits roll. So, Charlie, I have a question for you.
Okay.
That Targ.
Yeah.
Is he, like, the goodest boy we've seen in Star Trek thus far?
I don't know, because Porthos is pretty good.
Porthos is a good boy.
But yeah, it's definitely up there.
He's definitely a hecking Klingon doggo.
Like, if we were ranking the Star Trek pets, then yeah. would rank pretty highly. I love this kind of shit. Much like in TNG when they do a Lower Decks episode and you just see the perspective of the underlings, seeing this kind of alternate take on all the different ships is, it's great fun.
I love a good end credits gag, and the life of the Borg Lower Decks was hilarious. First time I watched it, I was laughing, I was cackling hysterically.
Yeah. I forgot about that, and seeing the Packled Lower Decks, it's like, yeah, of course they're idiots. But yeah, like the Borg one was a nice touch. And yeah, that the cadet that gets sent over to speak to Boimler, I did have Wesley Core written down. It feels like, you know, this kid is worryingly Wesley-ish.
He's probably the one kid in all of Starfleet who goes, Wesley Crusher, he was the coolest.
Oh god, yeah. He's the best cadet. He like had a weird gravity beam and would get to fly the ship. Like, what cadet gets to do that?
He probably has written like Gary Stu fan fiction about him meeting Wesley Crusher and Wesley going, you're all right, kid.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, ultimately, you know, going, oh, could I meet him? It's like, no, lost in time and space, mate. You know, as happens.
As worryingly happens in Star Trek. This has a very large guest cast list.
Oh my, yes.
I mean, it has, okay. The Klingon captain is played by Colton Dunn, best known as Garrett from Superstore.
Oh god! Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
My favorite character, and like since Rihanna and I both work in the same grocery store, when we've rewatched that show, there have been times I've gone, I'm the Colton Dunn of our store, right? And she's like, without the wheelchair, but yes.
Yeah, I can entirely see that.
We also have Nolan North, who plays the Starfleet cadet, and Soke and Taim.
Yes, yeah, Nolan North is, like, sometimes I can get a bit bored of his performance in some video games where he delivers a fairly flat, like, voice, but, yeah. Seeing him as things like the Starfleet cadet, it's like, oh, yeah, wouldn't have expected it from him.
I know him most from the cartoon Young Justice, where he plays both Superboy and Superman.
Oh, wow.
And it's the Connor Kent incarnation of Superboy.
Yeah.
Let's see. We also, Cary Walgren, and as Syvek, we also have Mark Evan Jackson from The Good Place, Thrilling Adventure Hour, Brooklyn 99, and I just have to say, I'm from Earth.
God, it's been a long time since I thought about Sparks Nevada, but yeah, I loved Mark Evan Jackson in that. And yeah, he's got such a good voice.
He's got a great voice, and like the what I think it's him. I kept thinking that he was. I kept thinking when I heard his voice, I kept thinking it was Diedrich Bader. Because they both have that very similar cadence.
Definitely. Yeah. Yes, and of course, Rich Fulcher as many roles, including the Packled Lower Deckers.
Of course, and Rich Fulcher. I never thought I would have... shit, what's the name of the character he plays in Mighty Boosh?
Oh my god, how could I...
Bob Fossil. He plays Bob Fossil. Yeah. That's why he doesn't like cricket.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd have Bob Fossil in a Star Trek, but of course he's playing a Packled.
Of course. God, two Mighty Boosh references in a single episode. A show which Emma and I watched during lockdown, and a lot of it has aged extremely poorly.
I can imagine.
Oh my, you've got some British sitcom classics going on in there.
Oh yes, of course. We're talking about blackface, aren't we?
We are once again talking about blackface. Yes, unfortunately. But yeah, some very fun voice actors. And it feels like we're, what, most of the way through season two on this by this point. You are getting some very good voice acting talent who are taking part in this. And it's just a delight. Again, Mark Evan Jackson, like, I want him to do some more fun, serious roles. You mentioning Dietrich Bader, it's like, yeah, actually, Mark Evan Jackson could give an interesting, like, Adam West level Batman, I feel.
Yeah, I don't know, like, other like, DC superheroes, I think he could play. I don't know, the Phantom Stranger.
Yes, get him as some proper, you know, like, not quite Brainiac role.
He would be good as, like, a Golden Age, like, hero. Like, yes. I think he'd be a really good, like, a Golden Age, like, Green Lantern or Wildcat.
Oh, actually, yes. Alan Scott.
Yes.
That'd be great. But yes, yeah. And this is our introduction to Lynn as well, which is really nice. Because, yeah, that Maverick, that wild card. I love how she is just fairly sensible still and immediately gets leapt on as far as, like, oh, you rule breaker.
I love the Vulcans. They're so bitchy in this episode. Like, she just says something completely reasonable. Fact, and they go out and, like, did you fucking hear that? She all but called me a bitch. My God, she's so emotional.
God, yeah, it's always interesting when you see things like Klingon society and Vulcan society, because as characters that were relatively one note, you do have that issue of, like, how the fuck do any of these work in society? And the Klingon one, it is difficult because it's all a fucking mess. Like, you've got a lot of, like, if I stand near this guy, I might be able to best him. In a
fight. It's like the Klingon society might be as stupid as the mirror, as the, like, the Terran Federation, but not as insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Or not a million miles away from the Romulan kind of, well, of course, I've been scheming to usurp the second in command. Well, I've been scheming to usurp the captain.
Ah, but you know that I know that you know. Rowan Atkinson in full Blackadder would make for a fantastic Romulan.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, so it was nice seeing that the Vulcans, sure, they are very stuffy and staid and bitchy about everything.
They're all incredibly passive aggressive.
Oh God. Like, I would not be able to live there.
Terrible experience. The thing is, okay, yes. At least when a bitchy Vulcan goes on logical fallacies, I know it's because they're an incredibly logical race and not just a guy who needs to stop being on fucking Twitter. Looking at you, Sean.
It's not still on Twitter, is he?
I'm not sure the court case forbids me from saying a lot.
Of course.
As always, the one thing I do like about the show, about Lower Decks, is that for the most part, it treats them very really. Like, when the Klingon captain gets got, he full on gets got with, like, gore and everything. And doesn't treat it like a joke, although he seems to be enjoying having been stabbed through the chest.
I mean, again, Klingon's gonna Klingons, Klingon.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and good for them. Like, if that's the way he wants to go out, just like, yeah, fuck it. Okay. Like, got bested.
He goes out doing what he loved. Getting stabbed by another Klingon in the fucking chest.
Many such cases, man.
Yep.
Yeah, and actually the timeout for the Lower Deckers on the Cerritos was quite good fun. Like, when there's an alert and everyone's running around the corridors dressed in, like, Shakespearean garb, all dressed in different kind of leisure wear, because, yeah, they've been all playing in different holodecks or doing all sorts of activities.
Do you think you'd get bored of living on a Federation starship?
I mean, they seem to do a good job of trying to make that not a thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing we just kind of forget about is this, that space is big, and so there is basically, I get the feeling that a lot of what they're doing on the Federation ships when they're doing exploration or like research work is basically alleviating boredom.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not the kind of world where you'd need to be in stasis for ages, like in Alien or anything. You just, yeah, fuck it. We've got a few hours a week to kill. We're not doing this for a wage. We can better ourselves or just have leisure time, enjoy ourselves, you know, maybe study because we're nerds.
Or you know what we could do? We could go climb a rock.
Hell yeah. Yes. Yeah, I did love the jumper that Boimler had on there with go climb a rock, which, well, we'll see soon enough when Captain Kirk is climbing a mountain.
Why is he climbing a mountain?
To make love to it.
Again, you know, a guy has to have deep space. A guy has to have hobbies.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, people have probably done worse.
Yep.
Especially with a holodeck that can do all this. This was overall a very enjoyable episode for these kind of things. For like seeing, again, that sense of, oh, you've got to be seen with the bridge crew. You know, you've got to have a bridge buddy, almost like reading Red Shirts and talking about that, about, yeah, like if we have someone that is a lead character with us, we're less likely to die.
I'm really glad that this version of Boimler is not the consistent version of Boimler.
Mm.
Because like I remember my first real complaint with the first episode of Lower Decks, first time I saw it, was it felt like I was watching a version of Red Dwarf where Rimmer was the main character and Lister was like, and Mariner/Lister is the sitcom arch nemesis.
Yeah. And
while Boimler does drop the Rimmer aspects of his personality, when it crops back up, it's always kind of like, nope, this web of lies is going to crumble sooner rather than later.
God, yeah, that kind of, yeah, I liked the Hawaii story.
Yep.
With that, and yeah, it is exactly the kind of thing that I could imagine myself doing in a workplace. Like, oh shit, I need to impress this person. Mild lie, and then yeah, no, I'm buckling under the weight of my deception, even though there are no stakes to this.
Yeah, a nice little joke about culture appropriation.
Ah, yes. So, with all that said, where do we want to put this episode of Lower Decks?
I mean it's a good episode. It's a good episode of Lower Decks. So, you know, it's, I don't know, what is, out of curiosity, I wonder what is our highest Lower Decks? And I'm not saying because this is the highest, I'm just out of curiosity.
It's the Moopsie at number 49.
Oh, I mean of course, you know, gotta love Moopsie.
Yep. Yeah, while not technically rankable on a list of Star Trek pets, it would still have an honourable place, really.
Yes.
Let's see. Yeah, under that 56, we've got empathological fallacies with the Betazoid MILFs causing mischief. I think this is probably better than that, but worse than Moopsie.
Yeah, the trouble with Lower Decks is, you know, it's the comedy show, and it's sometimes difficult to have to rank it against other episodes of Star Trek. Because it's like, how do you compare like the 25 minute adult animation parody show to say episode 55 Deja Q, which is the one above Illogical Fallacies on the list?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, that said, compared to some Trek episodes, going, look, this has an A, B, and C plot that are funny, yes, but it's a Star Trek.
These are A, B, and C plots, which all have set beginning, middle, and end in a 25-minute episode of television.
And they all tie together nicely, yeah, as well. So, fuck. Okay, I think this might be talking myself of it being above Deja Q, which is very good.
Okay, yeah. Then we have another comedy episode with 54 with Spock amok, where Spock gets body swapped with his fiance and hijinks ensue, even though both of them would refuse to call it hijinks.
Yeah, I think I like that one. I think this might be better than Spock amok,
even more than like Una and La'an playing Enterprise Bingo.
Oh god, I forgot about the Enterprise.
Because that's the C plot.
Oh, that's really good.
And that's a good, like, again, that's a good comment. Like, it's nice when, you know, because unfortunately, like, so much often, whenever Star Trek, the main live action shows try and do comedy, it usually devolves into, if it's not featuring Ferengi, we're going to have our really, like, qualified, well-trained professionals acting like idiots for 45 minutes. And it's here, it's La'an and Una going, wait a second, we're not cool. Let's try and be cool on our own terms, and hijinks ensue.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Okay, maybe then, I don't know, I'd be fine with this being under Spock Amok.
Yeah, because Spock Amok is really good.
It's delightful. Yeah, not only with the body swap stuff, which, you know, it's a science fiction show standard, but yeah, again, getting these people that are just like, hang on, we're not the cool ones, but this is a nerd ship for nerds. So yeah, even so.
Look, we're nerds. We know that there is a nerd pecking order.
Oh, horrifyingly so.
And you know what? It is sometimes very comforting to be in a situation where I go, look, I'm a Doctor Who fan. You guys are acting worse than us, and we're terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Like, with me as an X-Men fan, seeing Spider-Man fans and going, like, at least we're not them.
Man, you guys need to chill the fuck out.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Poor Paul.
I gotta ask a question.
Go on.
Who is worse, X-Men fans or Legion of Superheroes fans?
I mean, look, X-Men fans exist. Legion fans are me.
Okay, fine.
So, that's it from us. Next time, we're going to do some episodes where the titles are all Shakespeare quotes. So, yeah, get to see what light through yonder window breaks.
I really want to do the line from Titus Andronicus. You know which one. The audience know which one. It's the Yo Mama joke. Because Shakespeare invented the Yo Mama joke.
Of course he did.
It's the greatest line. Villain, in Titus Andronicus, when they find out that the Moor had sex with their mother, and like, villain, thou hast some dunce thy mother, and he's like, thou hast dunce thy mother.
Ooh,
it needs a mic drop. It's like, yeah, the Yo Mama joke existed back in Shakespearean times. Isn't history great?
Isn't it? So, yeah, we're going to have a lot of that next time. And yeah, until then, you can find us on Facebook, on our Facebook page for Casual Trek, on Blue Sky, on our Blue Sky account for Casual Trek, and on Ko-fi.com, where if you want to suggest things like episodes with titles that are Shakespeare quotes or puns or who knows, then throw us literally any money. We are not fussy. And yeah, also, Miles, where can people find you? And where can people see you?
Well, they can find me on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com. They can find me on my Blue Sky account at milesreedlibato.bsky.social. Or if you type in the Endless Bookshelf on YouTube, you might be directed to me on YouTube. Because you know what? I thought to myself, you know what? I'm a 40-year-old white nerdy guy. Podcasting isn't enough to me. I need to break out into YouTube. Like this. This needs to be on screen.
Impressive work. Yes. And yeah, I didn't realize that there was a Mothra novella until I saw your video.
Yeah, it just got published earlier this, like, late last year. And I picked it up along with the new John Scalzi novel, which I am looking forward to reading.
Nice.
And Charlie, where can the good folks find you?
Well, this is March, so it may be that The Lands Remaining, our role-playing game, is out. And if so, then I have an adventure in it. If not, then that's fine. Go to Faith Tales instead, where I'll be talking about some shit like 2000 AD.
And you've reached the Bendis era of X-Men, haven't you?
Almost. Almost.
What, you're almost at Bendis?
Almost at Bendis. Yeah, the writer, Bendis. Almost there.
Brian Michael Bendis?
Yeah, yeah, Brian Bendis, or Brian Michael Bendis, as some people call him.
He's a writer, right?
He does like to write, right?
The writer, Brian Michael Bendis, BMB.
Yeah, him.
Gets clearly paid by the word, right? Or the syllable.
You would hope if you were him. But yes, so yeah, you can see me there. And yeah, in the meantime, go do a Klingon Empire. Go do a Kronos. Fight with honor.
And live long and eat a jelly baby.
Or some kind of blood-based food. I can't remember what they have.
Don't eat actual babies.
No, do not eat actual babies. Do not do a Sarek.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.